March 3rd, 1976. Okay, now it's time for part two of our experimenting with the psychological impact of sounds. You know, and sounds can be very funny too. I know of a recording in which I think it was recorded in Europe, in which an entire sequence is played out of nothing but sounds, no voices, nothing but sounds, and you can follow the entire drama. And it's a very funny drama. But sounds, you know, by the way, speaking of sounds, before I go any further, you know, it has been said that, although, of course, that's comparative, but it has been said that this century, our time, is the most recorded century in the history of all of mankind. Now, they don't mean just virtually recordings, specifically recording. We mean a larger thing than that. We're very self-conscious. And for that reason, everything we do has to be recorded. Thousands of pieces of paper are kept on every possible tiny thing that happens. It comes out in triplicate. Now, you know about your own office. I mean, I don't care what office you work in. There's one guy that believes in everything that has to be made out in triplicate. And he can't tell you why. It's just a psychological urge in case you lose the other two, you know, he'll say. So, well, yeah, but we don't even need the first two. Oh, you never know. And so ultimately, everything is saved, and there are vast atomic-proof archives now all over. Yeah, just to save the papers. The people are going to go, but the papers are going to stay, man. And to me, this is our time. Very self-conscious. As a matter of fact, some of the great historical moments of our history came about because of our penchant, our fantastic desire to keep everything in triplicate. Good example of that was, you know, when they hauled all the guys into the dock at Nuremberg. I mean, you know, all the top Nazis. Well, the case was already shut because everything these guys did, even the bad stuff, somebody made sure that it was, you know, nicely. They had a receipt for so many thousand gold fillings. you know, it had to be all kept out in duplicate and triplicate. Guys signed it and stamped it and all that stuff. And nobody really knew why they were doing this, but except there was a fantastic urge for order. In the midst of total disorder, there's an urge for order. So in the end, after, you know, this fantastic chaotic thing is there with millions and millions of tons of paper, that told everything. No escape. Now, you see, Attila the Hun did not keep any records of the number of towns he sacked. He did not, you know. I can just see these guys, you know. Attila the Hun comes down out of the mountains with his marauding bands, and before they come in, see, Attila the Hun is addressing his troops. And I can just see the sequence. If it was like today, see, if he's like a modern man, I could see Attila sitting atop of his hairy horse, tough-looking horse, and he's got chain mail all over him. He's wearing one of these hats, you know, with the horns sticking out of the top, and he's got a shield. He's got this giant beard, and very smelly. You know, it's the recognized fact that the people of that period were very, very aromatic. And so here he is sitting atop his horse, and he's addressing his troops. And he says, "Aye, Attila! Attila on! Proclaim hereby that there will be no unauthorized rapes, and any rapes that are perpetrated will be recorded in the blue books which all of you have been issued. Make sure that you put
the carbon paper on a sheet so that we have a proper record in triplicate of any rapes that are made. Any pillaging that is done will be authorized by G2, and the proper forms must be filled out before we pillage. There will be no unauthorized raising of any innocent towns unless we receive orders in writing and in triplicate to make sure that there is no mistake from headquarters itself. Are there any questions? All right, men, we now march. We ride to sack Rome.
Okay. That's not a bad sequence. You like that? But that's the thing of our time. Everything has to be put down. And thousands of years from now, when all the dust has settled, archaeologists will be sifting through what remains of our time. Now, unfortunately, in spite of the fact that we have recorded many things, we have not accompanied the recordings with prefatory notes. Since we all hope that this, we know what this means. Now, for example, I have dug up a whole collection of recordings here that were recorded for sound effect purposes, but this is going to make a fascinating archaeological find 1,000 years from now. For example, here is the sound of a very typical, well, I should say almost an archetypical sound of our time, recorded with no explanation whatsoever, except it just simply says what it is, that's all. Dramatic, isn't it? Now, if you were sitting, though, in an archaeological laboratory 1,000 years from now, you would be hard-pressed to know what the hell that is. Well, what it was, and already, you see, it's gotten to the point where that sound is rare. That is the sound of a four-engine piston airliner taking off. There aren't many of those around any longer, and in 100 years, they probably won't even know what that sound is if they play it. You know, they can't figure it out because by that time, the piston airliner will have been so far past in history that no living man will ever have heard one and know even remotely what it sounded like. Now, here's a very rare sound. I'll guarantee you this is an extremely rare sound. And again, it's from history. And this is the actual sound. These are not invented or simulated sounds. It's the real thing. Now listen to this sound. This is a very interesting sound. That's a very interesting historical sound. That's a fascinating sound. You know what? If you'll reset that in there, because that's an intriguing sound. That is the sound of an actual SPAD, a World War I SPAD 13. Which was a World War I fighter. And by the way, the fighter that was used in the latter stages, this particular type of fighter, the French aircraft, it was the fighter that was used in the latter stages, that type, not this specific one, by Eddie Rickenbacker, who was the number one ace for the American Air Forces in World War I. And this, the sound of that machine gun is an actual sound of the Vickers machine gun firing through the prop of a genuine SPAD. This is not an artificial or a makeup or mock-up SPAD. It's the real thing. And this is the way a World War I SPAD actually sounded to a soldier in, say, a trench on, we'll say, the Marne River. A German soldier with a SPAD flying over, strafing the ground. Listen to this. This is fascinating. That's what they did largely, too, by the way, in that war. Deadly. Fascinating sound. Now, you'll admit that's going to make an intriguing archaeological discovery, a couple of hundred years from now. I don't know whether they'll know what it is, but it is a SPAD. The SPAD, incidentally, if you want to know how it got that name, the term SPAD, S-P-A-D, were initials. And it was the initials of the company that built that aircraft, Society something Aviation Department. It was an initial, S-P-A-D, a period after each letter. It became known then simply as the SPAD. Now, can you got the next cut? Now, this is a fascinating cut, because this is the same thing recorded, however, the same phenomenon, really, recorded decades later with the same situation pertaining. Now, what is this sound? Well, in case you're curious what that was the sound of a P-47 Thunderbolt fighter plane flying overhead. It was known also as the Jug, very, very lethal airplane. The sound of a P-47 strafing the ground, strafing an airfield, firing cannons. That was not a machine gun firing. That was a cannon, a 20-millimeter, I believe, cannon firing through... firing through the actual axle, the prop rotor. It's a very interesting phenomenon, which was a World War II thing. Now, do you want to hear it again? That was a 30-millimeter cannon blowing its nose. Let's hear that again, if you don't mind. Because it's so quickly, it quickly goes over, and it's a rare sound. Because this just simply wasn't recorded that much. This is the sound of a P-47 thundering over the ground, firing its cannon through the prop. What's the sound of that plane? Wow. what a lot of airplane. There aren't many of those left. Now, now we're going to go to an entirely different type of sound. Are you enjoying this at all? You know, sounds are really intriguing to me. And we're going to go down to an entirely different kind of sound. And in 150 years, I'll bet a lot of people are not going to know what this sound is, because by then it will obviously have changed a great deal, you know, what the way things are done. And here's the sound of a very common thing. All of you have heard this at one time or another. That's a scary sound. That obviously is the sound of a big city fire engine going on its way to do the thing that it does. And, you know, we tend to think of things as being almost permanent. It's hard for people to, at any time, anybody, to realize the thing that he's involved in or is so much part of his life will one day be absolutely gone. I mean, just gone completely. In fact, I was talking to a guy the other day, and he's not that old. That's what's so interesting about it. He's not that old. He's a man who used to work for a bread company over in New Jersey. And he's in his early 60s. He worked for a bread company. But the thing that made him interesting to me was that every morning he would get out when he went to work, this big bread company, big city, incidentally. This was in the middle of a great big city over in Jersey. He used to go out every morning, and the first thing he had to do was to hook up the horse. They delivered bread to stores, and in fact, they had a route. He called it the bread route. You know, he'd go out on the route with a horse. And every day he would go out with his horse. Now, he did not work in a farm. It was not a little town or anything like that. He worked for a big bread company that would be the equivalent today of a Silver Cup or Bonds Bread or something like that. And they went out every day and delivered bread. Now, what made it even more intriguing was that he said during the wintertime, they used to go out in a bread truck that was a sled. It had runners on it. Now, you always associate that with, you know, ancient days, way back. I mean, 1,000 years ago. This guy, he's about 62 or something like that, and he says that he did that. And he says it would never have occurred to him at the time when he was doing it that there would be a day when there just would simply not be any horses on the street, other than somebody, you know, maybe riding a horse at a riding stable or something. But it just would never have occurred to him that there would be no horses, period, on the street. Okay, I'm going to suggest to you that's possible, very possible, with the car. That we all accept the automobile without question. We just don't ever question the fact that there may be a day. And within a comparatively short time, let's say 50 years, that's comparatively short historically, there simply wouldn't be a car on the road. No cars anymore. Hard to believe. But it is very possible. This is WOR New York. We got everything official here. This is what archaeology is about, see, that there will be a day when people will gather in museums, let's say 500 years from now, and they will look at something which we take so much for granted today as part of our life. They will look at this thing as a really intriguing, romantic exhibit. Like, say, for example, a 69 Dodge, you know, which we just sort of accept. And yet, you know where this hit me? There's a museum outside of Munich. Fascinating museum. It's a museum of technique. You know, most of our museums deal with art. If you go to, say, the Museum of Art or Natural History, they will. You go to the Natural History Museum here in New York, and you're going to see skeletons of apes and all that sort of thing, which is all fine. It's natural history. You'll see prehistoric animals and so on. You go to a museum of art, and what do you see? Well, you see art. You do. You'll see tapestry, and you'll see armor, anything that could be classified art. But one of the most intriguing museums, personally to me, is the Museums of Technique and Industry. One of the greatest of all of them is in Chicago. The great Museum of Science and Industry, which, if you've never seen this thing, you just haven't seen a fantastic museum. What do they have in there? Well, I'll tell you, among other things they have in this museum, the Wild Museum. And as a kid, you know, we used to go in there every Saturday because it was just, you just could keep going there for a month and never even see a tenth of it. It's so wild. For example, they have hanging from one of the great rotundas as you come in there. It's just hanging right in the air. A stuka. And there it is. It's the real thing. A stuka. It's not sitting there just on the floor, you know, like some dead museum exhibit. It's a stuka, and it's hanging in complete markings. Absolutely authentic. It's the real thing. And it's a stuka that was captured in North Africa. And not only do they have the stuka, it's absolutely mint condition. They have a big placard that you can read as to how they actually captured this stuka, who was the pilot that flew it, what unit he flew it from, what day it was captured, and how it came about. And it just so happened that this stuka, if I remember rightly, was flown by a German lieutenant, and he ran out of gas, literally. He was flying a mission, and for some reason or other, he lost his power, and he came down not knowing exactly where he was. He thought he was behind the German lines, and he wasn't. He made a mistake. A plane came down and landed on an Allied airfield by mistake. He just taxied, and that was it. So they caught the guy. They pulled him out of the plane, and there it is. It's now hanging in the Museum of Science and Industry. And I can only tell you this. To see a scene like that, to see the stuka in absolutely mint condition, it's got unit markings and the whole bit all over, the big iron crosses, it's got the big swastika on the tail, and to see this baby hanging in there, that really brings history alive. Oh, I'll tell you, World War II suddenly becomes very alive. And in fact, in the same museum, they have a captured World War II German submarine, and you can actually go through the sub. Now, that kind of museum is fascinating, but outside of Munich, I ran into a museum that's in some ways even more intriguing because the stuff goes much further back. For example, in this museum in Munich, the famous Museum of Technique, T-E-C-K, as the word technique, T-E-C-K-N-I-K, they have, for example, 14th century fully restored, absolutely authentic carriages that people rode around in.
I mean, in the year 1340, can you imagine that? There they are. They're sitting there with wheels. And you could see where your step getting into this thing is worn. Worn by people who are, you know, 14th century people. That is really amazing. And I remember walking around looking at this thing, and you could see where actually, you know, people had worn things and carried things around. They have, among other things, they have a collection there of very ancient mechanical musical instruments. Like, say, if you can imagine the very earliest kind of an organ, you know, this is a mechanical instrument, it blows wind and all that, and it's pumped up. These things were 500-600 years old, and an old guy comes in and plays them for you, plays the kind of stuff that they play. It's wild, and especially when you look out of the window and you see the ancient hills of the Bavarian Alps out there. Oh, wow. I mean, you're really there. And I think that the day is going to come when archaeologists are going to sit around and listen to our commercials, and they're going to wonder about it. Well, it's your turn now, and you don't have to wonder. You know. Okay, Sam, let's hear that next one. How's that for a sound effect? Now, that has really fascinating, really fascination for a lot of people. That, of course, is reveille. And reveille, in almost all, you know that they play reveille aboard great big nuclear ships. So if you think that, yes, you know, if you think this is a thing of the past, it is not. It goes back into military heraldry, and it's one of the most ancient of all the forms of communication, is a guy blowing a horn. A horn can be heard. You know, this is one of the first things that the Neolithic man did, was to communicate with one another with shells, a horn that would create a sound that was louder and more piercing than the sound of the human voice. And so this is how the whole idea of communication with a horn grew up. And it remains today. Of course, in the military, whether it's the Navy or the Marines, and they're all the same, you know. The German Army, the Russian Army, all the armies around the world communicate with horns. One of the ones that did most of all, and still does, is the Japanese. The Japanese have a long history of blowing bugles late at night to confuse the enemy. And, here it is, 2 o'clock in the morning, all of a sudden you hear bugles blowing. That also happened in Korea. The idea of a bugle blowing at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning has a certain eerie quality to it. But anybody who's ever been in the armed forces, I don't care whether it was just 6 days ago or whether it was 100 years ago, knows the sound of a bugle blowing reveille. And, of course, it's all recorded. They play these recordings through huge PA systems, and, boy, you hear that at the crack of dawn, and you can already taste the rubber bacon that you're about to get. You're going to stand out there in the dawn. If you want to hear another, this is great. We know. See, in our century, we're all sitting here talking about reveille. We know what reveille means. But a guy listening to that recording, I would venture to say, 150 years from now, would not know what reveille actually meant. He would think it's some kind of a military, probably a herald sound or something, but he would not necessarily know what reveille meant. Reveille. That's what gets you up in the morning. And you hear that it usually in different places, sometimes at 5:15 in the morning, other times they'll blow it. It depends on the routine of the ship or the place you're at. They even blew these in subs. And they'd be a reveille sound at 7:30 or 8 or 5 in the morning, whatever they decided reveille was going to be. Now here's another one that's very, very totally identifiable. Now, that's an interesting call, because that would be known more to people who actually were in the service than the people who, you know, have heard. Because that's not heard much in movies. Now, that is assembly.
Now, you'd hear this at odd times in the Army or the Navy or the Marines. Just all of a sudden, you'd hear it in the daytime. Like, you'd hear the sound of that call. And for example, after you would have, generally, you'd have reveille. You'd fall out for reveille, see, and they'd take roll call and so on. And reset that again. I think I'll use that again. So you'd have roll call and all that at reveille. You'd fall out. And you'd go and you'd have something to eat. It would be breakfast time. You go back and you clean up the tent and all that sort of thing. And then all of a sudden, without warning, you would... Well, usually, of course, you knew what time it was, because you could tell what time these things go off. About roughly 5 minutes to eight, usually, in the morning, you would hear this sound. 5 minutes to eight, you're messing around. Nobody pays any attention. You just hear these all the time. You don't even watch. Okay, that tells you that within the next 3 or 4 minutes, you better get out in the company street because you're falling out now. It's called assembly. You're falling out for detail. And everybody lines up, and they've got the clipboard, and that's the whole day's action starts then at that point. They also blow that one before. This is blown. That one is blown before this next one is heard. This is a very interesting call. And one of the prettier calls in the services, and they're all the same. For those of you who don't know, the Army, the Navy, all the services use the same call, so they don't have separate calls. Although some are heard more often in some services than another. For example, there's certain calls that are heard in the Army that you'd never hear in, for example, the Air Force, and that's also true of the Navy. The Navy has special calls, like they'll blow a call to wash down the fantail. They have very exotic ones. You don't do many washing down the fantails in the Army. But here's one now. Again, this is a call that is heard, and it means a special thing to anybody that's ever been in. This is always kind of a dramatic moment in the Army, or the Marines, or the Air Corps. I saw a fantastically embarrassing moment one time when this was being blown. And then at that point, usually somebody off in the distance hollers, "Present! Hold!" And everyone comes to attention. That is called retreat. Now, retreat really means, not in the Army, retreat, like you're going to run. What it means is it's the end of the day. And they play that as they lower the flag. That is played just as the flag is lowered on the ship or on the post, wherever it is, and everyone is all lined up, and you're usually in a clean uniform. Every time I hear that, I associate a clean uniform with that. You know, you all line up. Yeah, it's all kinds of little things. You get out your clean uniform. It's retreat, see? Then after retreat, you fall out. And from here on in, yeah, you fall out. And from here on in, your day is your own, theoretically. And you can just sort of fool around. You go out. And then you go to chow, usually, after retreat. You go have something to eat, but the day is over. It's the end of work. And then this one, of course, is probably one of the most poignant of all. And all the armed forces all around the world have a version of this. And they all sound remotely like this. Most people don't quite know what it means. I will explain to you after it's played what it actually means. That's a beautiful call. By the way, this man is playing a bugle and not a trumpet or a cornet. A bugle has a different sound. That is tap. And most people believe that that's played at funerals. It is, as a matter of fact. But what it actually means is the end of the day, lights out. And that's a very romantic sound. I can remember hearing that echoing throughout dark camps late at night. You just hear it. It blows just quiet. Usually most guys are in bed already by that time. Many guys, because you get a lot of sack time in the service. Because, you know, sack time, as a matter of fact, is a really dynamic hobby in the service. You don't just do it to sleep. That's a thing to do, right? So often the distance you hear that tap blowing. And it means lights out, actually. It means the end of the day. That's what it means. The day's end. It doesn't specifically mean lights out. It means the day's end. Tap. And you can see why they would use it in connection with a funeral. The day's end. His life is over. And it's a beautiful call. And I wonder what they're going to think 100 years from now. This is WOR New York. You stay tuned for In Conversation, okay?